Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The FT.
Hello, and welcome back to the FT Arts Podcast. I'm Jan Daly, the FT's arts editor, and this week we will be discussing farce. It certainly seems to be popular right now. George Feydeau's 1907 farce, A Flea in Her Ear, is now previewing at the Old Vic in London. Alan Ayckbourn's Season's Greetings opened this week at the National Theatre, and also in London, the French farce Once Bitten opened next week at the Orange Tree. But is farce always considered to be a low form? People talk of low farce. Will it ever be considered proper theatre? And does it matter? With me to debate the subject are Sarah Hemming, the FT's theatre critic, and Sir Richard Eyre, the immensely distinguished director who is currently directing A Flea in Her Ear. Richard, what attracted you to Feydeau's play?
I saw it first in 1966 in this translation at the National Theatre under Laurence Olivier, and I thought it was just the funniest thing that I'd ever seen. I then produced it when I was running Nottingham Playhouse 10 years later, in 1976, and it's always stayed with me as one of the most enjoyable pieces of theatre that I've ever seen. And I don't like categories in any art form. I don't like those sort of walls that are set up generally by critics and analysts in order to compartmentalise art forms. What I think is it a good piece of theatre or is it a bad piece of theatre? And for me, it's an absolutely preeminent and wonderful piece of theatre. And in many ways, it's playwriting pushed to its apotheosis, because it's taking all the skills of the playwright, which are trying to compress events and plot into a plausible form in a very, very small time and a small set of a number of locations, and pushing that to its limit.
Well, certainly Michael Frayn has... It's often quoted as saying that writing his wonderful Fast Noises off was the most difficult thing he ever did. Sarah, is it a form that transcends forms, as it were? Can you see a farce as simply a piece of brilliant theatre?
Yes, and I think that when it is a piece of a brilliant farce, you don't see that because you're so busy laughing. I mean, that's what's so wonderful about it. I think one of the things that's enjoyable is that there is that great skill. I mean, you talked about Noises Off, which is a brilliantly constructed farce, which portrays a theatre company doing a bad farce and then shows the farce they get into while they're doing it. So it's incredibly intricate. And as in the audience, you can enjoy that, you can admire the skill, but at the same time, it works on you. It's like playing a special game. And as Richard says, it is for the audience as well. I think that word apotheosis is a very good one, because you're always complicit with actors when you're in an audience. And in this, you're complicit in playing this ridiculous game where you take a piece of logic and follow it. So, you know, you forget yourself and you laugh and you become a child again.
Is that what makes a good farce, somehow making us be a child again? It's more serious than that, though, isn't it?
I'm not sure. I guess, in a sense, all theatre is childlike, in that you have to enter into the game. You have to suspend disbelief. It's a sort of implicit contract. It's playing a game, being part of an audience. But I think it's serious in the sense that it's people often say farce is tragedy speeded up, and it does depend on hubris in the same way as tragedy does, that somebody has to aspire to, you know, something and be pulled down from the level of their aspiration, whether it's social or sexual or political. Farce doesn't work unless there's somebody who takes themselves very seriously, who need to, metaphorically and probably literally in farce, have their trousers pulled down.
So the characters, as you, I think, yourself wrote, have to have a lot to lose and a lot to fear. It, in some ways, the same set of circumstances that lead us up to a tragedy are the circumstances that suddenly turn a corner and become farce. Is that something that happens in this play, The Flea and Haria?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think the circumstances in it are not dissimilar in some ways to Othello, aren't they? And you would be pretty hard-hearted if you sat there cackling away at Othello. But I think one of the things about farce as a watcher, as a viewer, is that it allows you to laugh at things that are really very painful, whereas you would be very hard-hearted if you were laughing at Lear or Othello. And it also, in a way, you're watching people losing it on stage. We're all staving off chaos most of the time, I think, in our lives. And you're in the happy position of watching other people losing their trousers, losing their dignity, losing their relationships. But you're allowed by the form to laugh at it, which is very cathartic, I think.
Much needed in these times. In what ways is it different from directing, say, a Shakespeare tragedy? I mean, as a director, the skills that you bring to it, are they essentially similar?
No, they're much closer to opera.
Ah.
And strangely, I did a production of Carmen at the Met, which opened New Year's Eve this year, and I'd been re-rehearsing it just before I started rehearsals for Flea and Haria, and it was strangely similar, because what you have to do with a farce is follow the score. And the score is a three-dimensional score. It embraces movement, which is very, very precise, and rhythmic speech. And what is difficult for actors who come from a naturalistic psychological background is to accept that they have to play the score. So what you're doing first couple of weeks in rehearsal is pulling them towards the score and trying not to sacrifice their urge to psychologize, because that's obviously useful. They have to make complete characters, but on the other hand, they have to play the score, and that means tempo, rhythm, tempo, pitch, and being absolutely precise about it. And whenever anybody drops a stitch, I mean, it's exactly like somebody musically dropping a bar.
That must be quite difficult for actors with the training that they tend to have now, which is, as you say, towards psychologizing, towards working out the deeper motives and all the rest. That's not what you're looking for in your actors when you direct a farce, presumably.
No, but what you want is virtuosity. So you want actors who can do all that, give a character, be truthful, and at the same time see that the criteria are different in farce, and that while a sort of truthfulness is essential, it's also essential to abide by the musical score. And once they see that, once they embrace it, then they become completely obsessed by it, and they're absolutely determined to get the musical values absolutely right. So you do rehearse over and over again rhythms of somebody go ooh ah whoop ba um, and I mean literally that kind of thing. And you say no, the accent shouldn't be on the second beat; it should be on the third beat. And it's really as precise as that. And then once you're playing, you will hear the actors saying, I just don't think that's quite right. When the knot, surely the knot should come there, not there. And they've become, in effect, fast musicians.
It's fascinating. It is as if you are describing conducting an orchestra. So it's a very interesting analogy. And presumably the translation that you're working with is therefore also a work of art in itself, because that's where we get the English rhythms from. But just to go back to the origins of this for a moment, in Phaedo's day, was it a very groundbreaking form? I mean, were people shocked when at the turn of the century when this thing hit their stages with all its sexual innuendo and all the rest, or was it already a well-established form?
Not really. There was a well-established genre, and La Biche would be the predecessor to Phaedo. And what Phaedo was doing was sort of complicating and sophisticating what La Biche had done. But there was a tradition of boulevard theatre, of farce, and of sexual comedy. I mean, this is quite forthright. I mean, if you compare it to the Ben Travers farces of the 20s, I mean, this is a farce which depends for its plot machinery on somebody who suffers from impotence, who is has the longish scene where he describes his erectile dysfunction, and his wife has assumed, because he's been a very regular performer in bed, that he must be having an affair if he's not able to make love to her. And that's the premise of the plot, which is it's inconceivable in an English farce that that would be the premise of a farce.
Yes, it would, even until quite recently, I suppose. Well, I'm afraid we're almost out of time, but we'd love to have some Christmas recommendations from you both. This is a time of year when people love to go out. And of course, they will all come to see A Flea in Her Ear. But apart from that, is there anything on our stages at the moment that you would urge our listeners to
visit? I'm a bit party pre having run the National Theatre, but I would recommend Fella. Fella is a musical about an African musician. It's fantastically energetic, vital, rather moving, and has a political content too. And for me, it's one of the best conceivable Christmas shows, because I'm slightly allergic to pantomime.
Yes. Sarah, you get your fill of pantos at this time of year.
Yes, yes, I do. At the risk of overpromoting the National Theatre, I'd also like to remind people about Season's Greetings, which is a caustic piece, very moving, actually, comedy by Alan Ayckbourn about a bunch of relatives trying to have Christmas and making a spectacular mess of it. And if nothing else, it will make you glad for your own relatives, because they can't be as awful as these. I'd also recommend a small show for children, actually, The Young Vic, a very touching little Christmas show, not a pantomime, called My Dad's a Birdman by David Almond, which is funny and witty and has some farcical scenes in it. But it's really about a bereaved father and his daughter trying to overcome grief. He thinks he's a bird. It makes sense in the context of the play. But it's really, so that's a very touching. And one last very quick one, which is not Christmassy at all, which is King Lear at the Donmar Warehouse, which is exceptionally moving.
Definitely not Christmassy, but a 5-star production in your recent review. Well, that's it for this week. The Arts Podcast will be back next week, but for now, it only remains for me to thank my studio guests, Sarah Hemming and Sir Richard Eyre, and to you all for listening. A Flea in Her Ear is currently previewing at the Old Vic Theatre in London. It opens on Tuesday and runs until March the 5th. Don't miss it. The Arts Podcast was produced by Griselda Murray Brown. Goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.